All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm really itching to go today. All right, so we're going to jump right into this. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Bo, a representative of Refused Fascism LA, on the State of the Union. How about the State of Humanity? Before that, we'll be talking with Carl Dix, a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party, on the silence on the sentencing of Chicago cop Jason Van Dyke, found guilty of the second-degree murder of Laquan McDonald, and all of the other things that have come off of that, all right? So stay tuned to that. It's really going to be enraging, and you're going to learn a lot of stuff, all right? And opening the show up, I'm really this has been – with this guest, I've actually – he's one of the few guests that I've actually read all these things, and I thought – at the end of it, I thought – yikes. That's all I could think. And it's not funny. That's the problem. It's not funny at all. His name is Andrew Boyle. He's the counsel in the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. And we're going to be talking with Andrew about Trump and the danger of a declaration of a state of emergency and the broad executive powers that would give him. Basically, we're looking at this, that Trump, for people that don't know, Trump is talking about declaring a national emergency if the program that he has put out there is not implemented. Now, he does have power to declare the crisis and act on it, but has to justify the reasoning behind that with existing statutes. And the Brennan Center is, has identified more than 130 things that he could argue. Hi, Andrew.
Hi.
Okay. Found you. There you go. Got lost in the phone somewhere. Welcome to the show, man.
Thanks very much.
Sure. All right. Let's jump into this. The Trump has been talking about declaring a national emergency if his program is not implemented. You know, the program that he has right now, which is centered on the establishment of the border crossing and, you know, basically setting it off and stopping all this stuff and you know, setting a barbed wire wall, a giant wall. You know, now it's barbed wire and then it's going to be a giant wall. And that's his program in this instant. And it's something that is really people shouldn't ignore. They should take very seriously, not only for what it is in itself, but actually for all the things it also, basically brings up as sort of the possible way things could go. Now, I wanted to ask you this. He's been talking about declaring a national emergency if his program is not implemented. There's been a lot of opposition to it, but he's saying that he's going to declare a national emergency if it's not implemented. Now, he does have the power to declare a crisis and act on it, but he has to justify that reasoning with existing statutes. And the Brennan Center has identified more than 130 of the things that he could argue. Let's talk about that a little, because that seems to be yikes. That's the...
Yeah. I think that to sum it up in one word, that's an accurate reaction to the extent of emergency powers that are waiting out there, not only for President Trump, but for any president to use when he or she declares a national emergency. And I think that many Americans are unaware exist and are at the executive's disposal when a national emergency is declared. Obviously, there are times when you want an executive or president to have extra powers on a limited basis to handle true emergencies, but we don't think that getting money to build a wall on our southern border qualifies as a true national emergency, and that would be part of the debate, obviously.
And we'll get into this a little bit later, but there are other things tied up with that. It's, you know, to me, it seems like there's a whole wall that just busts open if this thing about the permission to build a wall along the border. This is, you know, there's sort of getting that or even whether he gets it or doesn't get it. He's opened up a whole argument about all kinds of, you know, what exactly is the power? You have a guy that's actually, I think, is a Nazi, and you're basically giving him just incredibly, almost unlimited power. And that's the first thing that jumped into my mind when they were talking about he shouldn't have the power to do this. And he's saying, I have the power to do whatever the hell I want to do.
Right. Well, his argument is that he has an absolute power to declare a national emergency. And we can certainly talk about whether there are any restrictions on that ability to declare a national emergency. In the statute itself, there are very few restrictions. But he is bound by the particular laws that declaring a national emergency then gives him access to. It does not mean that he can then do whatever he wants. And he, at the outset, may not have truly understood this. He would still need to point to particular laws, as you mentioned earlier, that he would try to use to then get this funding. And I think if there were ever court cases challenging any emergency declaration to fund the border wall in this way, that much of the litigation would revolve around whether these particular statutes that he points to are being used appropriately.
We'll get into that a little bit more as we go through this. But what does it, just so people know, What does this mean? What would actually happen if he did this? If he basically declared a crisis and acted on it and basically built this wall, not even leave the wall. You know, the wall is sort of just the symbol for me right now. But what would it mean if he actually seized these powers and said, this is what I have the power to do? And you guys have identified more than 130 things that he could argue, you know, and that's fairly heavy. What does it mean, though? What would it mean for him to, for that to actually happen?
Right. So the governing statute here is something called the National Emergencies Act. This is a statute that was passed back in 1976, right after the Watergate era. There was a lot of concern in Congress that the president had way too many powers at his disposal at that time, over 400. And all he had to do was declare it a national emergency, and he had access to all of these powers immediately. So they were actually trying to put more restrictions on a president's ability to use these emergencies. They terminated a number of emergencies that were in existence at the time, and they said, okay, there's certain things that you have to do if you want to declare a national emergency in the future. Now, they didn't define what a national emergency was, but they said you have to transmit it to Congress, and you have to be explicit about which of the powers you're going to use when you declare a national emergency. You know, to use it in, and I know we'll talk about this more in a bit, but to use it in regards to building a wall, you'd have a situation here where Congress has said, we don't want to fund this program that you're trying to use, and the president would then be using emergency powers to essentially circumvent Congress, which is not the way that emergency powers are supposed to be used.
Now, but this is the thing, too, though, because, you know, OK, he's declared his intention when, and he actually did this when he was delivering the state, you know, the State of the Union in his primetime TV address. He did it a little while ago. The two questions would be I have is, would he be able to do that? Would he be able to actually say, this is what I'm doing. I'm the president. To hell with you. I'm going to do this. And to hell with all the laws that you're going to throw at me, because I have the power to do this. You know, it's sort of, and what would happen if he does declare a national emergency over the border wall?
Yeah, so I think if he declares a national emergency, you know, based on immigration or whatever, in order to fund the border wall, I think very, very quickly there would be litigation. The question is, who would have standing to challenge us? Congressional standing is one possibility, although that is a rather tricky thing. Another possibility is landowners or environmental groups across along the border that would be impacted by such construction. The other option is for Congress to terminate the emergency. Congress has the ability to pass a resolution essentially terminating any emergency declaration that the president has declared. However, under constitutional law, they would have to then send that resolution to the president himself for his signature. So, assuming he wouldn't veto his own emergency declaration, they would have to have a veto-proof majority to terminate any national emergency declaration.
Which we have to remember what we're talking about in terms of the who these Congress people are and what they're voting for and allowing. I mean, these are people who have, I mean, they may have minor differences when you're looking at the Democrats and Republicans, but at the same time, they have not been actually, you know, real examples of standing up against what, again, all the stuff that Trump has brought to the picture right now since he's been in office, all the things that he's brought to the whole world in terms of that are scary things, that are actually things that, you know, could mean huge changes in the planet and the existence of the planet if you really wanted to get down to it. You know, he's declared all kinds of his intentions. But you guys, the Brennan Center, and this is something that really struck me, you guys have identified more than 100 statutory powers, because this is the thing. Trump is president. Now, you've identified more than 100 statutory powers that a president can activate in a national emergency. And if he declares a national emergency over this border wall, what happens?
Yeah, so if he declares a national emergency over the border wall, there's probably, you know, if you look at the language of the particular statutes of these 136 odd statutes that he would have access to at that time, there's really a couple that stand out as probably the most likely for him to use. And those essentially involve two things. One involves taking money that has been allocated to Department of Defense projects and reallocating that money to other defense-related construction projects. Now, obviously, that would raise questions about whether a wall along the border is in support of a defense-related, in support of the armed services and things like that. The other involves moving money that has been allocated for Army civil works projects. So, for example, building levees or something in Louisiana, taking that money and reallocating it to other projects. However, that particular statute that I'm referring to doesn't provide authorization for new projects. And so there would be litigation about whether, you know, he has the authorization to build this wall, even if he can find the money to do it.
But here's the thing, you know, there's an extraordinary machinery operating in this whole concept, because the 100 powers that the president can, the more than 100 powers that the president can invoke at the stroke of a pen, you know, they're extraordinary powers. And again, the authoritarian, you know, talking about being authoritarian at best and fascist for real, when I look at like what's actually being laid out there, you know, National Emergencies Act of 1976, all these things that actually give the president unbelievable power. If you know, and I think a lot of people in this country have no idea what somebody like Trump could actually unleash and run with.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, the powers, there are far scarier powers that he would have access to in relation to potentially other emergencies than the ones that would give him money potentially to build a wall. There are powers that could potentially be used to take control of portions of the internet. There are powers that could be used to prevent persons within the United States or American citizens from having a job and being able to earn an income or pay for a roof over their heads. One of the things that there is perhaps a silver lining from Trump's threats to use these emergency powers in a way that was blatantly not how they were intended to be used, is it's raised the profile of these, and we think that Congress should really dive in and reform the ability of the president to use these emergency powers and what powers he has at his disposal.
Of course, that really depends on the Congress standing up against Trump in general, which it does not seem to be a very big thing. They don't have a lot of interest in doing that. And one thing that the Brennan Center has identified, I mean, well, first of all, actually, this is really important because this is an extraordinary machine, you know, and you think about this, these extraordinary powers, and again, I'd say they're authoritarian at best, and I think they're fascist in reality. Now, you look at this and you think of state of emergencies have once declared can last a very long time, that there's 25 states of emergency that have existed longer than 10 years, and 13 were declared just since 9/11. And, you know, you think about this, and what does that mean in terms of the threat? Just let's leave it at that level, the threat of the establishment of a fascist rule in the U.S.
Yeah, even going back further, the longest-running emergency declaration under the National Emergencies Act is from 1979, and the National Emergencies Act didn't come into effect until 1978. So the year after, you're talking about the Iran hostage crisis, the emergency that was declared after the Iran hostage crisis is still in effect to these days. To this day, and the reason it's still in effect is because the administrations and Congress since then is reliant on the various powers, specifically powers of sanction against Iran, that they have access to under those declarations. But that's clearly not how emergency powers are supposed to work. They're supposed to be a temporary exercise of power in order to give Congress time to decide how they want to deal with a particular issue. And they've, in that emergency and in other emergencies, they've had plenty of time to address that those issues through legislation, as opposed to allowing it to just perpetually be addressed through emergency powers. And that is one aspect of this that we think needs to be reformed. There needs to be checks placed so that these powers are not abused for year in and year out for decades and decades.
You know, that's the thing, though, is that, you know, as you guys have said, with these 136 emergency powers, and, you know, 96 of them can be activated by the president alone with a signature or an emergency declaration. You think about what that actually does look like. And I'd like to talk about that a little. What would it mean? You know, like, for instance, would it mean take over and shut down of radio stations, suspend laws prohibiting government testing of chemical and biological weapons or whatever on unwitting human subjects, which, you know, they're really good at doing that in secret. But what would it actually allow them to get away with?
Well, that really depends on the individual statutory provisions. Like you said, there's over 130 of them. There's 136 of them, and each one they address really a wide range of things. Yes, some of them would allow them to potentially shut down radio stations. Some of them would allow them to test biological weapons, as I mentioned earlier. Some of them would be allow the government to target the ability of American citizens to earn a living. So there's a wide range of some scary, some mundane laws as well. Some are so old but still on the books that they've become completely outdated, that they're no longer effective. But there's been no effort to sort of reform them. And some, you know, you could ostensibly say, okay, that's reasonable. We would want a president to have those powers in an actual emergency. So the problem is really twofold. The problem is, how can we put additional constraints to make sure that a bad faith actor does not declare an emergency where one does not actually exist just to have access to these powers? And what are the powers that he would then have access to? And how can we make sure that those powers are sufficiently constrained so that Congress continues to have a role and the people, the American people, have their voice through their representatives?
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we are talking with Andrew Boyle, who's the counsel in the Liberty and National Security Center at the Brennan Center. And we're talking about Trump, his border wall, and the threat of all the moves that he's been making in terms of declaring a state of emergency. Now, tell me this, because I'm really, you know, it's actually, if people haven't heard of this, and I think a lot of people just are going through the day and are thinking, okay, there's this, you know, back and forth. The Congress doesn't want to do this. They don't know. He's declaring he's going to set this state of emergency if they don't let him do what he wants to do. But people aren't really looking at actually what this lays the foundation for. And the power of declaring a national emergency does allow him. I mean, this is another thing that really kind of, you know, it's important for people to realize what is at stake here, because the power of declaring a national emergency enables him to set aside many of the legal limits on his authority, the things that you were just talking about, the various limits that could crop up. This national emergency would enable him to set aside many of those legal limits. That's a pretty dangerous situation.
It is dangerous, and obviously it's also scary to have a president who's willing to so blatantly use emergency powers or declare a national emergency where everyone recognizes that it's not actually a true national emergency, because that lowers the bar for future presidents to go down a similar path. You know, there's no realistic contention in this situation that however you perceive what's happening on the border in terms of immigration, that it's a true national emergency that Congress has not had time to address. In fact, the president has explicitly said that he's just sort of holding back emergency powers as an alternative if he doesn't get the money from Congress that he wants to build the wall. And that's not how emergency powers are supposed to work.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, do you think, I mean, because here's the thing again, what Trump says, I mean, I think a lot of times people, you know, okay, people are like, oh, he's a liar, he exaggerates, he does all these other things. But a move like this is not something that should be looked at sort of, you know, just, in passing. It's sort of, this could be a major development that I think, you know, look, this country is headed in a very, I mean, very, very dangerous direction. And it's, you know, I've never been a fan of it to begin with, but when I look at this and I think that the possibility of the rise of fascism, what's going on, what the threat is against the rest of the world, what the threat is to the planet in general. I mean, you think about this, the very ability that they have to declare a national emergency and set aside the limits on his authority to declare that a national emergency opens the door to, when he declares a national emergency, that opens the door to 100 special repressive provisions become immediately available to them. That's pretty heavy. You know, I read that in the piece that was put out by you guys, and I thought, wow, that and just declaring the emergency opens the door to 100 special repressive provisions. Let's talk about what some of them are.
Sure, yeah, and I think that the fact that just declaring national emergency gives them that access is why there needs to be, why we would advocate for Congress to reform the National Emergencies Act, to put into the National Emergencies Act a definition of some parameters that can be pointed to for what a true national emergency is. Provisions dealing with imminence, provisions dealing with unforeseeability, things like that, such that if a president were to declare a national emergency outside of those sorts of situations, they could be challenged in court and stopped because there would be language detailing what an emergency is. And then in terms of what the particular powers are that he would have access to, we've discussed many of them. You know, some of them are truly scary, the ones that would allow him to take control potentially of the internet. Now, it's important that your listeners understand that these are interpretations applied to the internet of statutory language that was passed before the internet even existed. But that's how some persons within the administration are interpreting them today. Other powers that would allow them to conduct biological experiments on unwitting American citizens. These are very, very scary things, and they need to be looked at now that people are more aware of, that they exist and that the president can use them and potentially use them in a bad faith way. They need to be looked at more closely.
Yeah, you know, the thing though that still gets me is that we're still, you know, when Trump was elected, a lot of people laughed when he was running for office. Then he gets elected, and a lot of people are like, "Whoa, what does that mean?" And then they get a little bit used to it, and things go along, and he does this and he does that, and then every now and then there's a big shout out like, "Oh, what's he doing?" Can they go along? You know, and the Congress has shown itself more than capable of going along with him, and basically. There's this system, there's this thing that's going on now that I think is extremely difficult because even the things that you were just talking about, the internet kill switch, I mean, he could seize control of all internet traffic, which actually is a huge thing. It's not like it was in 1962. You know, it's not like, you know, oh, yeah, they're going to stop the newspapers. Get Jimmy Olsen in here. This is like, no, this is something that's really, really intensely, it's very important. And it's, you know, there's all the presidential powers that he has, they're very hard for people to actually challenge. And I think that complacency in this situation would be a really big mistake because I really do believe that we have a guy who has declared, if he hasn't come out and said, "I'm a Nazi," he's actually made it clear that those are his people, you know? And I think that that's the people that get, you know, rallied by him, that do all this stuff. And he is actually fomenting all that, and it's building up a powerful force in this country that can cause a huge amount of danger and can actually, you know, think about what would happen if you really did, if this kind of regime consolidates its power, takes over all this stuff, and then goes out to teach the world a lesson. Complacency would be a very big mistake.
I completely agree, and that's why we at the Brennan Center, first of all, hope that President Trump does not declare a national emergency to get funding for his wall. I think that would be a huge mistake and a huge violation of the National Emergencies Act and how it was supposed to be used. But we also hope that this prompts both the people and the legislature to push for reform to the National Emergencies Act and the way that executives can use emergency powers.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and we'll keep reading your stuff and getting back to you, okay?
All right, sounds good.
All right, Andrew, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Andrew Boyle, who's counsel in the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, on Trump and the danger of a declaration of a state of emergency and the broad executive powers that would give him. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Carl Dick, so stay tuned. Santana with Migra. Okay, really just a great song. Can't get enough of that. All right. A while back, we focused a lot of attention around Laquan McDonald, who was killed by a Chicago cop on October 20th, 2014. A young black man. The young black man was 17 years old, and he was standing surrounded by cops when Jason Van Dyke, the cop, drove up, got out of his car, and started shooting. He shot 16 times. The cops at the scene, the investigators, and the mayor Rahm Emanuel, you remember him from being, what was that president he was best friends with? Yeah, were all part of a cover-up. But in November of 2015, a judge ordered a dash cam video released, which showed the truth, and it was a cold-blooded execution. Van Dyke was tried and convicted last October of second-degree murder. And a judge has now pronounced his sentencing, and we'll talk with Carl Dix about this. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
Yeah, so let's jump into this, man. So what's going on with this? People should be, I mean, you know, I read this and I really, you know, I wanted you to get be on the show no matter how long it took to get you on. I wanted you on the show because this is such an outrage. It's an outrage around the killing, you know, and it's an outrage around the killing and it's of Laquan McDonald, and it's an outrage for what it pretends for what it portends for the rest of the rest of society. This is an incredible step forward in what I think, you know, look, the cops have always been somewhat fascistic in relation to black people in particular and other oppressed nationalities, but this seems to be something that is really people need to pay attention to very, very carefully.
Yeah, I mean, this verdict, and the verdict was 6 years, 9 months, but what it actually comes down to is a little bit more than 3 years, because you get half off of a sentence in Illinois, good time for good behavior, and that's like as long as you don't beat up a guard or something, which is not something this pig is going to end up doing. So he's going to do 3 years and walk out. Just to be clear, he was convicted of more than just second-degree murder. He was also convicted of 16 counts of aggravated battery. And in Illinois, aggravated assault and battery is a more serious crime than second-degree murder, if you can believe that. Mm. And what the judge did is the judge threw out the 16 counts of aggravated assault and battery, went to the second-degree murder conviction, which allowed him to give a lesser sentence, and then went to the bottom of what could be given on that charge. And it really was the judge saying, hey, this wasn't so bad. In spite of the video that shows Laquan McDonald walking away from the cops when Van Dyke pulls up and gets out of the car and immediately begins to shoot and shoots him 16 times, most of them while Laquan McDonald is laying on the ground. In spite of the year-long cover-up that went up to the mayor's office, up to Rahm Emanuel's office, in spite of the massive protest, and also in spite of the content of the sentencing hearing, because here at the sentencing hearing, they brought in some black people who had experience with Van Dyke and his form of policing, who had been called the N-word by Van Dyke, who had been brutalized by him, who had been pulled out of the car and violently thrown to the ground, had his gun pointed at them, all of whom had done nothing wrong. This is the evidence that was brought in for the judge to consider when sentencing him. And in spite of all of that, he went for the lowest possible sentence, and one that would have this guy who had a history of terrorizing black people on the street with his badge and gun out of prison in 3 years, 3 years plus. This was like another assault on black people. And it basically says to you, and it happened right around the anniversary of Martin Luther King Day. So here you have this day when there's all this hoopla about how far black people have come. But you get a statement from this court, this judge and court, on where you're actually at. Okay, yeah, slavery's over, Jim Crow segregation and lynch mob terror is over, but the police still got a license to brutalize and murder you on the street in cities across the country. And even when you catch them, even when you get one, even when you get a little bit of justice, because this happens, killings like Laquan McDonald happen all the time all across the country, and usually the cops get away with no punishment. You get one, and what does he get? A slap on the wrist. And we have to go to, and I don't know if you were planning on getting to this, that this sentencing happened the day before.
Yeah, I want to.
The cops. Okay, we want
right,
to get to that.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah,
we got to talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so outrageous. I mean, you think about this. You know, what it says. This verdict came one day after a crew of other cops were found not guilty after covering up for the murderer Van Dyke. They saw what happened. They were part of the whole thing and part of that whole scene. And they get they, they are found not guilty. This in itself is a major outrage, and you think about what that concentrates. Let's really dig into that, man, because that, I think, is something that people, whatever you hear, you know, people can get jaded real easy. But when you see something like this, and it just has to snap your head, you know, because you have to look at, you're confronting what the reality of this society actually is.
Yeah, and see, this really goes to how this system is supposed to work. Because the day before this judge sentenced Van Dyke for the murder of Laquan McDonald, three of the cops who wrote lying reports to justify and cover up Laquan's murder got exonerated, were found not guilty. And in exonerating them, the judge picked up the themes of Van Dyke's defense attorney. Because one of the things this judge said was, well, I looked at the dash cam video, but it doesn't show the perspective of the police who felt like their lives were threatened, who felt like they had been victims of assault and battery. I mean, and you look at the video, Laquan is walking down the street. He seems distressed. He tries to stab a tire. But then when the cops come, he's walking away from the cops when Van Dyke kills him. These three cops submitted reports that said the opposite, that he was walking towards the cops, that he had his knife threatening them, and that Van Dyke had to kill him. They put these reports together after sitting and watching the dash cam video, which showed the opposite of what they wrote in the report, talking it over, and then writing their reports in similar language, which showed a coordinated effort to cover this up, and one that they expected to be successful, except for the fact that they had considered the outrage that would be sparked and the continuous protest and the digging that forced the release of the dash cam video and forced Van Dyke to be put on trial. But see, the way that this happens is police kill somebody and then they get together and figure out and lie to cover those murders up. And then that's how it's supposed to go down. It's not supposed to go any farther than the police come in with a report that rubber stamps whoever the murderer of whoever the police just killed. And that's supposed to be the end of it. This case got pushed out in the open, but this judge shoved all of that aside and said, yes, the real problem here, the threat was Laquan McDonald. Even though there's a video showing that's not the deal, the police perspective was different. Now, let's just look at this. There was some reality, and the reality was that Laquan was walking away from the police when Van Dyke started shooting at him, and he was on the ground when most of the shots were fired. These police submitted reports that said that didn't happen. They lied about what really happened, but were found not guilty of having lied about what happened, even though that's clearly what it did. And it does say to you, what is it that we're up against? We're not up against just a few rogue cops who brutalize and murder people. We're up against a whole system. We're up against other cops who form a blue wall of silence and lies to cover up and justify those murders. We're up against a political structure that operates to keep their frontline enforcers out there with a green light to brutalize and murder people, and a judicial structure that exonerates the cops. It usually doesn't prosecute them, and in the few times they're forced to prosecute them, does their best to exonerate them. This is what you're up against, and it's why Bob Avakian says in his talk that's on video, why we need an actual revolution, how we can really make revolution, that the terror the police carry out against black people and others is stitched into the fabric of this system, and that it can't be reformed away, and it requires an actual revolution to end it once and for all.
This is the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix, a representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and we're talking about the police murder of Laquan McDonald in Chicago and why injustice for black people is built into this system. Let me ask you this, because I want to pursue that even more. But I did want to ask you this. For a lot of people, you know, they, people keep thinking, I mean, even when you were talking about the people that are called out in this, that are actually, you know, you begin, people can begin to get a sense of what the reality is in justice in this country, you know, that it's injustice in this country. And you get the idea that, you know, you talk, you know, there's a big problem here, because basically we should talk about, I think we should really talk about, what does this say about in the time that we have remaining? Let's talk about, what does this say about justice in America with regard to the police and in general? And you think about even people, when you were talking about the people that were involved in all this, let's not forget Rahm Emanuel, who was like, remember the big celebrations? Oh, black man coming, he was with Obama. He's like, he's down with us. And all of a sudden, and other people, and white people out there saying, well, this will be good. This will be good for the, you know, this is a whatever. And Chicago's moving in a progressive direction. And when it comes right down to it, the cops, the mayor, all the people that run the society have the same interest. Even though they might argue and bite each other's toes every now and then, they got the same damn interest. And it says a lot about justice in America and what it's going to take to change all this.
Yeah, because see, when you talk about the structure and whether you can change things through it, what's really put before you is choosing who's going to preside over the horrors brought down on you. Because Emanuel came out of the Obama machine, and this was supposed to represent new style Democrats taking over in Chicago from the old Daley machine, and it was supposed to bring a different way for people in Chicago, and especially that was told to black people. What did you get? You got a mayor who presided over brutalizing and murder people, and not just in an off in the distance way where he wasn't really clear what was going on. This video of the police murdering Laquan McDonald went all the way up to the mayor's office, and the decision not to release it came from that level. The cops, the whole structure was backed up to the mayor's level in not releasing that video until the massive mobilization that went on for a full year created a situation where they had to back up, because someone within the system who was aware of the video put the word out that it was there, and they couldn't hide it anymore. They couldn't keep it under wraps. But even with that, what you get out of this is the cops who lied to justify it, which is a key part of keeping this brutality and murder going, exonerated. And the cop who you got a picture of, a movie of, a video of him carrying out the murder, getting the lightest possible sentence. And in fact, the judge bent the law in doing this, because the judge justified the sentence by taking the dissenting opinion from a higher court to justify tossing out the other convictions and only sentencing him on the one that would allow him to give the shortest possible sentence. He didn't take the decision of a higher court. He took the dissenting opinion, the opinion that didn't hold in that court, in order to justify what he did. So kind of bent the law here to do this. And this tells you that when you work within this, in the confines of this system, what you get is you get to choose between poisons. And look, there's a lot of fighting at the top, especially right now. And I'll just say it. The pigs have always been an occupying army, whether you got a Democrat or a Republican presiding over. Right now, with Trump, Pence, and the fascist crew that they represent, they're unleashing the pigs to be even more brutal against black people. But let's be real clear. The murder of Laquan McDonald and the murders by police of hundreds of people every year was going on under Obama and continues under Trump. And while we need to drive the Trump, Pence, fascist regime out, that is not the solution to this horror or any of the other horrors this system brings down. The actual solution is getting rid of this system, because these horrors are stitched into the fabric of this capitalist imperialist system. And it'll take revolution, an actual revolution, to end those horrors once and for all. And I really recommend that people watch the film, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. It's a film of a talk by Bob Avakian that addresses those questions. And he walks through how these horrors are built into the fabric of this system, how they can't be reformed away, they can't be voted away. It's going to take a revolution. And he gets into how we could really make revolution with a real chance to win. And people can see that film on the website revcom.us, and I really encourage people to do that, to check that film out, and to get with the movement for revolution that Bob Avakian and the party that he leads is forging right now.
You know, I can't think of anything more important to say around that because, you know, you look at all of the atrocities going on, whether you're talking about the threat of fascism coming up from, you know, Trump and what he's doing now and what that would look like and what it could do to people. And it's more than just to me, it's much more than even the horrific things they can do in terms of the superstructure, how they actually could change things very dramatically. But what it would mean for people. And, you know, I had been in South Africa, which you could call a fascistic state in relation to black people. I had seen other places that had fascists actually running the place and been, you know, in there. But, you know, it's really people don't understand that when I think or they're just closing their eyes to this, and people have really got to wake up to what the reality is in this country and what it means for the world. And then don't just stop there in an intellectual way, but actually decide what the hell you're going to do about it. Because it's no good. It's no damn good if you're sitting around saying, "Well, yeah, you know, it's getting tight here, man." You know, it's kind of, you got to actually decide where you're going to be. Any comments?
Yeah, no, that's right. It really does come down to looking straight in the face of the reality that we're up against and seeing what it means just every day for people around the world and in this country. And then saying, okay, what does that mean I need to be a part of doing about it? Mm-hmm. And like you say, it's not an intellectual exercise. It's not a thing of making a calculation and seeing how I can, you know, find the least discomfort. The point is to look at the massive discomfort around the world and in this country and confront whether you can roll with that world. Because you got two choices: either leave humanity suffering with all of this suffering, or do something about it. There's not a middle road for you to travel. You either got to be a part of stopping this, or it's okay with you that it goes down. And people should really not become the kind of people who can be okay with horrors like this coming down. If the only problem with this system was the way that it gave a green light to its frontline enforcers, the brutal murdering pigs, to brutalize and murder people, that would be reason enough to get rid of it through revolution. And that's far from the only problem. Mm-hmm. And there is a real solution to all those problems, and that solution is an actual revolution. And people need to get with the movement for revolution that the Revolutionary Communist Party is building.
All right, Carl, I want to thank you very much for joining us today, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Okay, thanks for having me on, Michael.
Sure, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and basically, here's what, we're going to take a quick musical break, and we're going to be right back with Bo Logan from Refuse Fascism LA talking about the State of the Union. Yep, the State of the Union. That'll be interesting, so stay tuned. He's not satisfied, I'm not satisfied, and you shouldn't be satisfied, all right? Because it's hellified if you're satisfied, all right? There you go, you got it. What's it mean for the rest of the world? If for you to be satisfied in the world that exists today, it's going to mean, just remember this, it's going to mean horror for the vast majority of the people on the planet, okay? You cannot be satisfied. You got to be dissatisfied, and then think about all that, all right? Now, before we get into my conversation with Bo, I wanted to let all of you who are listening know that this interview took place just before Trump's State of the Union address, but also involved crucial questions for all who are alarmed and disturbed by what's going on in the world and in the U.S. and don't want to accept the fascist America. All right. I'm very pleased to bring to the show, when we're talking about people who are dissatisfied and refuse to sit back and say, huh, well, okay, what can you do? Or, oh, yeah, that's interesting. We have this fascist regime coming in and, you know, it's interesting. I'm reading up on it. Important to do all that. But you also, there needs to be other things going on. And I'm really pleased to welcome to the show Bo Logan from Refused Fascism LA, who's going to talk with us on the State of the Union and how about the state of humanity. Bo, welcome to the show.
Hi, nice to be here.
Yeah, good. Well, let's jump into this, man. Tell us what's going on. What you guys got planned?
Well, I mean, look, if you're sitting back and you're seeing all the outrages that are coming down, more and more intensified by Trump and Pence and all that this fascist regime has unleashed, and you're saying to yourself, well, it seems like all I can do is rely on the Democrats. Well, you got to shake off that kind of thinking. And what Refused Fascism is doing is it's presenting an alternative. It's saying, let's get out into the streets. Let's start getting out in the streets on February the 5th. And let's say we're not going to go along with Trump-Pence regime anymore. Now, this is also happens to be the day of the State of the Union. So this is an appropriate day to kick off getting this movement going again.
Now, this thing, the one thing is that this is a... It's a call for a night of refusal and a rejection of fascist America, which is actually seems that that's a pretty important standpoint here. I mean, in terms of people looking at what we were just talking with Carr about, what we were talking with my first guest about, the direction that things are going in, it's not in no way sort of facetious to be talking about fascist America.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, look, you take the particularity of this border wall, you know, this monstrosity that Trump's talking about. It's not facetious. It's not an exaggeration to say the policies that Trump is trying to push through are fascist. I mean, what he's doing to these caravan of people who are forced to come here, by the way, because of the operations of this system, people from Honduras are forced to come here because the U.S. has gone and messed up other countries so bad that they have no option. And then this is equivalent of setting someone's house on fire and then shooting him as they choose to leave. And then, again, what are the Democrats' options to that? Well, let's just build a smarter version, a more high-tech version of oppressing people whenever they flee violence. And so both those options are bankrupt. But in particular, Trump's is a horror on top of a horror.
Mm-hmm. And that's important to get into because, you know, you think about this. And again, I do think it's a, you know, and it should be. People need to know that this is not just people in L.A. or people in California, that this is a call that's going out to people all over the country. You know, and what we've been talking about in this show has been actually the need for people to open their eyes and then to respond. You know, we don't call for, you know, actual specific actions on the radio because they don't let you do that, you know. Mm-hmm. But it actually is. It's news. When you want to say that this is happening, you can say that. But the point is that you're looking at all this, and basically, when I thought about the slogan for this demonstration, which I think is really important, you know, and you can give that slogan again, but it's really important because it says no to all of the attacks from the Trump regime and those that might be going along with them. It's you know, and we'll talk about that in a minute. That, you know, when you talk about like the Democratic Party complicity on for things like border security, I mean, or family separations and asylum seekers, you know, they're complicit even on the level of ethnic cleansing. They have not done anything that they have not put themselves on the train in front of the train and said, stop, run me over if you got to, but you're going to stop. You're not going to get away with this. You know, and that's the kind of thing that I think we really need to, you know, for people really need to understand that that's the kind of situation we're living in right now.
Yeah. The slogan for it is refusal and rejection. I mean, we're not going to go along with this. We're not going to continue to go along with all these horrors that are being unleashed. No more relying on saviors to Alice's fascist regime.
What are we talking about there when you talk about no more relying on saviors?
Look, we can't have hope that, like, there's just some magical being that somehow is going to come down and solve all this, or hope that, you know, this blue wave of Democrats that got elected to serve, again, the same system that Trump and Pence are serving are somehow going to be the solution to this. When ultimately it comes down to, if you're working within this system, you're going to be confronted with having to achieve what's necessary to make this system continue to go on. So the Democrats, the Republicans, whoever it is that's elected, are going to continue to perpetuate this system. And so we got to rely on ourselves, because we are the only people that actually have the interests of humanity at heart.
This is the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Bo Logan from Refuse Fascism LA and the Los Angeles Revolution Club. And we're talking about the fascist Trump regime and why people have to resist. Now, if you want to make a case to people about why they should be standing up around this, let's make it now. If you had to actually think about this, if you had to actually say to people, look, and without calling on people to do something, for people to understand why they need to stand up against this, you know, why they need to actually say, you know, look, this isn't acceptable, and what to do. What would you say if you really had to sit down and you were confronting a group of people and you said, where are you going to be? And then these people started giving all kinds of answers. And what would you say to them about why they need to be in a different place?
Well, I'd say to them, what are your priorities? I mean, are you just looking out for yourself, or do you care about the people of the planet? Do you want to see these horrors come to an end, or do you want to just find a way to go along with all the horrible things that are being unleashed? And if people want to find a way to go along with it, I'd say, good riddance, get out of my way. And I go looking for the people who say, no, I want to bring this to an end. I want to do something about it. And I say, I want to unite with you, and you've got the right sentiment. And so let's get out there and let's do what's necessary.
Now, for you, you're a veteran. Mm-hmm. And as I've heard and understood and hearing you talk, and that had a big, big impact on you in terms of what you saw that this country was capable of doing to people. And it changed your life in a way. Let's talk about that a little bit, because I think a lot of times people don't understand that it doesn't take a whole lot. People generally don't have to like say, I'm completely changing. But when you run into things that are like what we're facing today, or when you run into things like you did as a soldier, what did you, you know, let's talk about that. All right. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. I mean, as you said, I was in the military and I did serve in this imperialist army's wars in Iraq. What I was confronted with was that it wasn't the illusion that they present to you, that somehow the U.S. is over there being a force for good in the world. And the more and more I come to front that, I thought to myself, well, maybe it's just one administration versus another. But then I had to deal with the fact that the same policies were being conducted under Bush as they were being conducted under Obama. And so I had to start digging more and more. And I actually had to first confront the fact that the U.S. isn't conducting anything that's good, you know, in the interests of humanity. But then, luckily, I stumbled across this great group called the Revolutionary Communist Party. And they actually helped me further understand by showing me that the science of why it is that the U.S. carries out the policies that it does. It's actually in service of a system of capitalism, and in particular, capitalism imperialism as it manifests today. And in order to ensure that that system can continue to exist, the U.S. is going to continue to operate its armies the way it does. And then once I was confronted with that, I said to myself, well, again, am I just going to be okay with that and say, well, I figured it out for myself and move on, or am I going to be part of actually doing something about that? Mm-hmm. And this, what's happening on Tuesday is a great way for people to actually be a part of doing something about this.
And Bo Logan, you know, I think about this and I think about all the people that are with you. I think about all the people that need to be with you. And in the call for the protest, it makes the point that fascists can come to power through elections, but you're not going to drive them out through elections. And this is an extremely important thing for people to understand. So once again, folks, you know, I'm going to give Bo the last minute. We have about a minute and a half left to do. So you want to make a call to people about why they need to stand up. Go ahead and do it.
You need to stand up because it's the right thing to do. It's the thing that tomorrow or the day after, when you say, I wish I could have done something, this is the way you could have done something. So please come out, stand with humanity, stand with the people of the world, and be part of driving out this fascist regime.
That's right, folks. Don't sit watching by yourself, disgusted and outraged. That's what it says here. Bounce from your home, all right, and flood the street corners. So basically, it's Tuesday, February 5th, protest the State of the Union at address in State of the Union address in the name of humanity, the Trump-Pence regime must go. Sisters and brothers, this is actually, you know, look, we're living in a world that demands a lot more from us than any of us may have thought. You know, there was a whole period where a lot of people thought that things could, you know, you can change this, you can change that, you can go to the elections, you can do all this other stuff. Actually, what people maybe are learning and should be learning is it really requires understanding what's going on, and it requires understanding who's, you know, who actually is the cause of it. What's the cause of all the suffering that people have here, and whether you're going to stand up against it or not. And realize, too, that what you do here actually has impact on what's happening to people all over the world, all the kinds of things that are going on, the horrors that are being plagued, you know, that are plaguing people all over the world. You know, if you're not part of the, and this is something that, you know, I think it's actually had truth. You know, it's not real deep, but it is, in one level, it is real deep. If you're not part of the solution, you are part of the problem. And that becomes a big thing in a situation like this. If you sit by and idly watch it go, the whole world's in big, big trouble. All right. And that brings us to the end of the show. Bo, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, definitely. And I want to thank all of my guests today. I want to thank my engineer today, Teddy Robinson. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and all of my guests and each and every one of you for tuning in. You want to write to me? You can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. All right. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And we are going out with a song that I just love, okay? And that's 99 Revolutions.
Working